I'm Christopher Lydon. Reading Chekhov is the name of this game. Safe indoor sport with what everybody says is the greatest short story writer of them all. We've been doing this for a few weeks, and it's fun for all sorts of reasons, mainly because Chekhov is ageless and everywhere. Originally in Russian, of course, but he's a universal figure. Also, though, his friend Gorky said there are so many special qualities about Chekhov, which we're still learning, but among them, Gorky said, Chekhov, he makes you want to be a better person. He makes you want to live a truer life, to see life more clearly. But for me, one of the great charms of reading Chekhov aloud is simply that he keeps inviting digressions and conversations about all manner of things, philosophical or practical, not particularly Russian, but about our world, about today, about who we are. So those are a few of the reasons that we gather and continue to gather to read this guy. So tonight in the season, I just want to read this very, very brief story called Vanka. It's a Christmas story. It's only 4 pages long. And we'll see what it means. I'll just begin and then pass the baton. Before we begin, please, everybody, just tell us who you are.
I'm Abdi Ali, and I teach English and Humanities in the Boston Public Schools.
I'm Sarah Barton, and I'm an actress with the Wellesley Summer Theatre Company.
I'm Ken Cheeseman. I'm an actor, and I'm an artist in residence at Emerson College.
And I am also a school teacher. My name's Elizabeth Albritton, and I teach English as a second language in Needham.
We're also joined by a group of guests we'll call the Greek Chorus, who will be reacting as they like, interrupting, I hope, digressing, bringing it home, making it real. So let's plunge with a story called Vanka. I'll begin and pass the baton. Vanka Zhukov, a 9-year-old boy, sent 3 months earlier to be apprenticed to the shoemaker Alyakin, did not go to bed on Christmas Eve. He waited till master and apprentices went to church, then took a bottle of ink and a pen with a rusty nib from the master's cupboard, spread out a rumpled sheet of paper in front of him, and began to write. Before tracing the first letter, he looked fearfully several times at the doors and windows, cast a sidelong glance at the dark icon surrounded on both sides by long shelves of shoe lasts, and heaved a choking sigh. The paper lay on a bench, and he himself knelt down by the bench. Dear Grandpa, Konstantin Makarich, he wrote, so I'm writing you a letter. I wish you a Merry Christmas and all good things from the Lord God. I have no father or mother. You are the only one I have left.
Vanka raised his eyes to the dark windowpane in which the reflection of the candle flickered, and in his imagination distinctly saw his grandfather, Konstantin Makarich, who was night watchman on the estate of some gentlefolk called Zhivarev. He was a small, lean old man, about 65, but remarkably lively and agile, with a smiling face and eyes bleary with drink. In the daytime he either slept in the back kitchen or sat joking with the cook and the kitchen maids. And in the night, wrapped in a great sheepskin coat, he walked round and round the estate, sounding his rattle. After him, with drooping heads, went old Kashtanka and another dog, called Eel, on account of his black coat and long weasel-like body. Eel was wonderfully respectful and insinuating, and turned the same appealing glance on friends and strangers alike, but he inspired confidence in no one. His deferential manner and docility were a cloak for the most Jesuitical spite and malice. He was an adept at stealing up to snap at a foot, creeping into the ice house, or snatching a peasant's chicken. His hind legs had been slashed again and again. Twice he had been strung up. He was beaten within an inch of his life every week, but he survived it all. Granddad was probably standing at the gate at this moment, screwing up his eyes to look at the bright red light coming from the church windows, or stumping about in his felt boots, fooling with the servants. His rattle would be fastened to his belt. He would be throwing out his arms and hugging himself against the cold, or, with his old man's titter, pinching a maid, or one of the cooks. "Have a nip," he would say, holding out his snuffbox to the women. The women would take a pinch and sneeze. Grandfather would be overcome with delight, breaking out into jolly laughter and shouting, "Good for frozen noses!"
Abdi.
They also give snuff to the dogs. Chestnut sneezes, turns her nose away and goes off feeling offended. But Eel, being respectful, does not sneeze and wags his tail. And the weather is magnificent. The air is still, transparent and fresh. The night is dark, but the whole village can be seen. The white roofs with little curls of smoke coming from the chimneys. The trees silvered with hoarfrost. The snowdrifts. The whole sky is strewn with merrily twinkling stars, and the Milky Way is as clearly outlined as if it had been washed and scoured with snow for the feast. Vanka sighed and dipped his pen and went on writing. And yesterday they gave me what for? The master dragged me out to the yard by the hair and thrashed me with a belt because I was rocking their baby in the cradle and accidentally fell asleep. And last week the mistress told me to clean a herring, and I started with a tail. So she took the herring and began shoving its head into my mug. The apprentices poke fun at me, send me to the pothouse for vodka, and tell me to steal pickles from the master. And the master beats me with whatever he can find, and there's nothing to eat. They give me bread in the morning, kasha for dinner, and bread again in the evening. And as for tea or cabbage soup, that masters grub up themselves. And they make me sleep in the front hall. And when their baby cries, I don't sleep at all. I rock the cradle. Dear Grandpa, do me this mercy. Take me home to the village. I just can't stand it. I go down on my knees to you, and I'll pray to God eternally for you. Take me away from here, or I'll die.
Vanka twisted his lips, rubbed his eyes with his black fist, and gave a sob. I'll rub your tobacco for you, he went on. Pray to God for you. And if there's ever any reason, you can whip me like a farmer's goat. And if you think there'll be no work for me, I'll ask the steward, for Christ's sake, to let me polish the boots, or go instead of Fedka to help the shepherd. Dear Grandpa, I can't stand it. It's simply killing me. I thought of running away on foot to the village, but I have no boots. I'm afraid of freezing. And when I grow up, I'll feed you for it, and I won't let anybody harm you. And when you die, I'll pray for the repose of your soul, as I do for my mama, Pelageya. And Moscow is a big city. All the houses are manors. There are lots of horses, but no sheep, and the dogs aren't fierce. There's no children's procession with the star here, and they don't let anybody sing in the choir. And once in the window of a shop, I saw hooks for sale with lines for all kinds of fish, really worth it. There was even one hook that would hold a 30-pound sheepfish. And I saw shops selling all kinds of guns, like our squires, worth maybe 100 rubles each. And in the butcher shops, there are black cock and hazel grouse and hares. But where they go to hunt them, the shop clerks won't tell. Dear Grandpa, when the masters have a Christmas tree party with treats, take a gilded nut for me and hide it in the green chest. Ask the young miss, Olga Ignatievna, and tell her it's for Vanka.
Vanka sighed spasmodically and again stared at the window. He remembered how his grandfather always went to the forest to fetch a Christmas tree for the masters and took his grandson with him. Oh, they had a merry time. His grandfather grunted, and the frost grunted, and looking at them, Vanka also grunted. Usually, before cutting down the tree, his grandfather smoked his pipe or took a long pinch of snuff while he chuckled at the freezing Vanyushka. The young fir trees, shrouded in hoarfrost, stand motionless, waiting to see which of them is to die. Out of nowhere, a hare shoots like an arrow across the snowdrifts. His grandfather cannot help but shout, "Catch him! Catch him! Catch him! Ah, the short-tailed devil!" The cut-down tree would be lugged to the master's house, and there they would start decorating it. The young miss, Olga Ignatievna, Vanka's favorite, was the busiest of all. When Vanka's mother, Pelageya, was still alive and worked in the master's house as a maid, Olga Ignatievna used to give Vanka fruit drops, and having nothing to do, taught him to read, to write, to count to 100, and even to dance the quadrille. But when Pelageya died, the orphaned Vanka was packed off to his grandfather in the servant's kitchen, and from the kitchen to Moscow, to the shoemaker, Aliakin.
Come, dear Grandpa, Vanka went on. By Christ God, I beg you. Take me away from here. Have pity on me, a wretched orphan, because everybody beats me, and I'm so hungry and it's so dreary, I can't tell you. I just cry all the time. And the other day, the master hit me on the head with a last, so that I fell down and barely recovered. My life is going bad, worse than any dog's. And I also send greetings to Alyona, to One-Eyed Yegorka, and to the coachman. And don't give my harmonica away to anybody. I remain your grandson, Ivan Zhukov. Dear Grandpa, come. Vanka folded the written sheet in four and put it into an envelope he had bought the day before for a kopeck. After thinking a little, he dipped his pen and wrote the address to Grandpa in the village. Then he scratched his head and reflected and added, Konstantin Makarevich. Pleased that he had not been disturbed at his writing, he put on his hat and, without getting into his coat, ran outside in just his shirt. The clerks at the butcher shop, whom he had asked the day before, had told him that letters are put in mailboxes, and from the mailboxes are carried all over the world on troikas of post horses with drunken drivers and jingling bells. Vanka ran over to the nearest mailbox and put the precious letter into the slot. Lulled by sweet hopes, an hour later he was fast asleep. He dreamed of a stove. On the stove sits his grandfather, his bare feet hanging down. He is reading Vanka's letter to the kitchen maids. Eel walks around the stove, wagging his tail. December 1886.
It sounds so like Dickens in Russia, 1886, right?
Yes.
Ken, I'm just thinking, you're playing the Christmas Carol.
Uh-huh.
But we have a sort of a Russian Tiny Tim. Mm-hmm. No Scrooge, but I mean, this is in the big league, it seems to me, in four pages.
Yes, it's funny because I should have studied up for this. I do not, I know that there is influence either with Dickens to Chekhov or Chekhov to Dickens. I can't remember who influenced the other. It must be Dickens
to Chekhov,
influencing Chekhov, yeah, because of the dates. You definitely feel it in this. You feel that ability to find the nuance in the everyday. There's something of economics and of social status that both people explore too, and so responsibly.
Also an incredibly precocious voice. This is a 9-year-old boy.
Right, right.
Does the letter get to Constantine?
I know.
No way.
No.
To my grandpa somewhere.
He added his name at the end, didn't he?
I know.
But how many Konstantin Makariches are there?
In the village.
Does he have the name of the
village? No. The village.
Does he need a stamp?
Poor boy.
Although you wonder, I mean, knowing small children, almost because if you're tender-hearted, you hope that he's making some of this up.
Yeah. No, that's the precocious touch, too, I think. Can I ask an off-the-wall question? But it happens a lot in Chekhov. Who are these dogs? This eel who gets beaten within an inch of his life every week. But there are a lot of dogs in Chekhov's stories.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure quite what freight they're carrying. Do we know?
The dogs resemble the masters.
Yeah.
Like
the roguish watchman has a roguish dog.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a comment on family legacy. The grandfather liked the dog, beaten with an inch of its life, and the Tiny Tim grandson.
Yeah.
Also put upon by this family.
I think the dog in this story would be the little boy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Remarkably respectful and gentle, looked with equal tenderness on his own people and on strangers, but enjoyed no credit.
But it's Eel gets the last word. In the boy's imagination, he's walking around the stove in his grandfather's house, wagging his tail.
He always recovered.
The jury out there, what are we thinking?
Well, I mean, he gets set up so that the master beats him. So essentially, remember that part when he says, my life is worse than the dog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he feels as if his existence is worth an eel and the rest. I think he would be eel if he had the choice,
yeah.
You know, just to escape his reality, and I think that's what so beautiful about the connection he makes with the dog.
Mm.
And to feel like he has a home, he's at home.
Exactly. He's not home, exactly. Yeah.
But again, it strikes me this is a very one of many, many political stories in a sense, but it's also very Dickensian. The boy at some point rubs his eyes with his black fist, and you're immediately thinking of Dickens's, you know, servitude in the blacking factory. He's a 9-year-old boy, and he's being worked to death.
This is like Dickens chapter one, and then it's over.
I know. Yeah, I know.
There's no, like, you know, oh, you're my long lost, you know, nephew or anything. It's just going to go downhill.
He's just left with his fantasy that will never come true. Maybe the letter will get to him.
But, you know, the other thing is he gets that gift of the beautiful night's sleep, you know, in a strange way. Even though the letter will never reach the destination, it's almost like the hope that he clings to is like his own, the gift to himself.
Fascinating.
That he does sleep well, and he does have these images of this letter being written, you know, being read by Grandpa on the stove. And so it's almost like he creates his own oasis out of his horrible situation. Also interestingly, through writing and through what he sends out into the universe. Mm.
And the truth is, if it did arrive, he'd still be an apprentice.
Yeah.
It's not like they'd get the letter and say, oh, we've made a terrible mistake. Yeah, bring him home.
Bring him home.
Yeah.
He's been there for 3 months, so it's perfectly natural that he'd be writing this letter.
But I don't know, there's this quality in Chekhov. I mean, I think of him as a kind of forever warning of a collapse. This can't go on. There's an injustice with this boy. There's a corruption in the whole game between Moscow and the villages. I mean, he is writing this not aware, of course, of the revolution, but a lot of his stuff has this kind of pre-revolutionary stirring. This is a bad society, and in some ways even darker than Dickens's London.
But it's interesting because he's not really yearning for a life beyond his own. You know, he's not envious of anyone else's life. He's yearning for his childhood life and Grandpa has a kind of a sweet surf gig. You know, he's walking around the estate in his sheepskin coat, kind of drunk and addled and pinching the maids, walking around with his watchman's rattle. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a kind of a fantasy life. I just want to go home.
Yeah. Is that some kind of metaphor too, that the night watchman isn't really all that particularly concerned with being a good night watchman? He just wants his snuff and his women to pinch. And
but also on the political social front, just the urban versus the rural.
Yeah.
You know, it's that there's something about that rural life of just the dogs and the, you know, there are horses here, but there's no sheep. And, you know,
and they don't know where the birds were shot. They have no idea.
Right.
Yes. Lewis, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because this is throughout Chekhov's stories, everybody's leaving the village for Moscow or leaving Moscow for the village. And I don't know how it averages out, but there are fantasies both ways, and a lot of people aspire to the big time. They want to be actresses, they want to be musicians, they want to be scholars, they want to be somebody, so they go to Moscow. And here's a 9-year-old kid who's just dying to get back to Grandpa in the village.
Well, his mother sort of prepared him for a different life, no? Right? Because she says, you know, he talks about when Vanka's mother, Pelageya, was still alive and worked in the master's house as a maid, Olga Ignatia used to give Vanka fruit drops and, having nothing to do, taught him to read or write, to count to 100, and even to dance the quadrille. Right? It's a very, very different preparation for a life that's not about becoming a shoemaker of some kind, right?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If mom was still around.
I'm sort of holding on this thing that Lewis said about getting that good night's sleep. And this concept of happiness, and how do we define what happiness is? And that word, to me, happiness, is related to happenstance or things that happen. It's momentary. It's not anything that is sustained. It's something that's a moment. And I feel like Chekhov grabs onto that really well with his stories. Mm. And each of these descriptions, the getting the gumdrops, learning to count to 100, getting the good night's sleep, putting the letter in the mailbox, those are these little moments of a character's happiness. So I think in terms of the pre-revolutionary time that Russia is in, there's something of that, that yearning that you're talking about, that the characters want to go to Moscow. I just want to be happy for a minute, you know, and the way he describes it is just so elegant.
You know, I'm sorry, it's from Russian. It depends where he lives. We don't know where he lived. If he lived deep in Siberia, he has no hope to go to Moscow. Also, we don't have to, we have to remember that peasants didn't have passports. They could not travel. They were trapped for life in their villages. They had absolutely no freedom, you know.
So then that pursuit, though, is for that moment, that moment of...
It's just a dream.
A letter,
it's
or...
It's not reality.
Or the grass is always greener idea, too. If you're in the city, you dream of the country. If you're in the country, you dream of the big, bright lights of the big city. You know?
Right.
There has to be some element of pure just separation, you know. And that's quite universal. I mean, that's, right, isn't that Chekhov right there?
And those great details along with that.
Yeah.
You know, that it's not like, I'm dying, save me. It's like, you know, and say hi to one-eyed, you know, Yegorka, and don't give away my harmonica. Mm. You know, like the voice of a child, but also sort of the just beautiful details.
Yeah.
So what are we learning about Chekhov in four introductory pages? I mean, one tiny little story, and yet it does have that quality of truthfulness, of a very clear picture, beautiful detail, miniature version of huge national trends, but human emotions. What more do we want to say in just wrapping up on the, I don't know, the pregnancy of this little story about a little boy in the Christmas season in Moscow, longing to get home to grandpa, an orphan?
I hope he makes it.
Well, I'm curious about how would Chekhov meet Ivanka? Is this autobiography or is this a patient that he might have treated?
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah. He's a doctor. He's also a writer. He lives in the country and the city. He came from the countryside to go to medical school in Moscow, and he never stopped traveling. But that's a wonderful question.
Yeah.
I'll bet he'd had a patient like this.
Yeah. Who came in after an awful beating of some kind.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can imagine, though, your imagination just going wild, you know, just considering one of those children that you'd see every day in the street, if you stop to think about how it was for them when they started this new life, what would that be? It's almost like you could just see the child in the street. At least I imagine that he could just see a child and make this.
Yeah.
I think the little joy that you see him about his harmonica things, there's a huge sense of optimism and a sense of the resilience of the human spirit. I mean, Chekhov lived the pre-revolutionary Russia, and times were incredibly tough, to say the least, you know, but there was always something about the human spirit that always aspires, that always hopes to one day, maybe not this Christmas, but, because I guarantee he's going to keep writing Christmas letters for the next 30 years to Grandpa, if he has to.
If he has, yeah.
And I think that's the Chekhov, and, you know, no matter where you are, what your status is, that there's still hope, that there's still, you can still find happiness in whatever reality you have.
Yeah, there's something. It's a miserable picture, and yet there's a redemptive pulse there.
Yeah,
that's the thing you were saying about what does it say about Chekhov? Just the layers, you know, of it. Like, it's got this sort of harsh social commentary about, you know, working in this horrible conditions, but then this sort of optimism of this child and the beautiful detail and the sort of humor and the descriptions of the dogs. It's like he's got like 30 layers all kind of simultaneously going on.
Yeah.
Can I just add something? That even in nowadays Russia, there is two sentences from this particular story are idiomatic. So whenever we say Дорогой Константин Макарович, dear grandpa, Constantine Makarch, everybody knows what it refers to.
Really?
To the village. No, how does it say? To grandma, to the village, на деревню дедушки. It's a diomatic expression when you don't know where to write, we say like...
That's amazing.
So this is very famous.
But that's so fascinating. To grandpa in the village.
Yes, and we all
and this
know
is a gesture
where
of a
who knows where.
It's fatalistic, right? It's quite fatalistic.
Wow.
So you don't know where to send.
Yeah,
like, or, what? What? Oh, just send a grandpa.
Or would it express kind
North
of hopelessness
Pole.
Too, or like
it's
a Don Quixote
kind of a little
kind
of humorous aspect.
Yes.
Yeah.
But innocent hope.
It's like a here goes
no,
nothing.
No, there's no hope. It's like
I can tell.
There's no done. The mail doesn't arrive. Right? The mail doesn't arrive.
Maybe just enjoy a good night's sleep and face tomorrow. Tomorrow. So what do we say about Chekhov? We say thank you, Anton Chekhov, for Vanka, and we'll do it again. Thank you, Abdi. Thank you, Sarah, Ken, Elizabeth. The Chekhov story was Vanka. From 1886. Most of us were reading from the translation by Richard Pevyar and Larissa Volkonsky. Listeners out there would be delighted and grateful to hear your take on the story and on our impressions of it. Leave a comment, please, on our new and improved website, radioopensource.org. Next on our list, if you're inclined to read ahead, is Chekhov's little drama of a tramp titled Dreams. Mary McGrath produced and edited this first crack at reading Chekhov. Special thanks to the audio master, Jim Donahue, who wired us all for sound. And thanks to our chorus of friends and commentators in my living room. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of our open source project.